This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 13th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on this program, what we've learned about one of the largest satellites in our solar system. A conversation with a recent visitor to the University of Arkansas, Dr. Ralph Lorenz, about Titan, the largest moon orbiting Saturn. And Don House is taking pictures of us again, how the photographer keeps capturing the essence of Northwest Arkansas. First, though, a pair of our partners at Ozarks at Large sit down to discuss business and politics. Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net and Michael Tilley of TheCityWire.com sift through a week's worth of news, including a major appointment for Congressman-elect Steve Womack, and how, now that there's been some time to digest the news, the city of Fort Smith is reacting to the sale of Baldor Electric to Swiss-based ABB for over $4 billion.
Well, it was certainly a surprise. You know, Baldor has, their culture has always been very focused on staying independent, staying in America. You know, Raleigh Borum, the CEO, legendary CEO and chairman before, you know, he preached, we don't cut jobs and we're not going to move overseas for cheap production. We're going to focus on quality. So that, I think a lot of us were surprised that culture of independence and self-reliance just kind of is out the window when ABB, a Swiss-based company, comes in. It was certainly a good deal in terms of money, although there are some law firms trying to pile on to say that there was a breach of fiduciary duty of the shareholders or whatever, but at a 40% premium per share sale price at $63.50, it was a good deal for the company in terms of just the value. In terms of what the community, I think the community is just kind of holding its breath. Does that Baldor culture remain? ABB said they're going to keep the headquarters in Fort Smith, and you know they don't. Their whole take is we bought Baldor because they're good at what they do. We don't want to mess with what they do. So, but we'll see. You know, Roby, we'll see down the road if ABB sticks to that. There are going to be 3 or 4 years where these energy efficiency rules are going to make the products that Baldor makes going to make them very profitable. Be higher margins on them. That's what ABB is after. Once those margins go away and the market normalizes somewhat, you know, will everybody still love each other when the honeymoon's over? That, I think that's why we're kind of holding our breath.
You broke a story this weekend that I suspect is going to get some national attention. Trucking giant Arkansas Best, which has been trying to pull itself out of the red by reworking a union contract, looking for other expenses to cut, revealed some public documents between it and the Teamsters Union regarding some of these discussions they've been having about cutting costs. What did we learn?
Well, we learned that one thing to learn is that the union, the Teamsters, are very concerned, I think, about the future of YRC, Yellow, the old Yellow Roadway Company, which is the largest less-than-truckload carrier with Arkansas, with ABF being number two. In the documents, we learned that the Teamsters wanted ABF to acquire YRC, and that, you know, if they would consider that, then maybe ABF and the union could come to different terms in terms of wage concessions. You remember, this got started when the union gave YRC a 15% wage cut and some other breaks on the contract under the National Master Freight Agreement. ABF wanted some of the same breaks since they both have unionized drivers, and it's supposed to be a one contract fits all companies type deal, and the union wasn't as accommodating to ABF as they were YRC, and so it looked like the union was trying to use a little leverage that, you know, hey, if you guys at ABF will buy YRC and kind of solve some of those financial problems there, we'll work with you on a future contract.
All right, Steve Womack, the congressman-elect from the 3rd Congressional District, received a very influential seat for a freshman, or for a veteran for that matter, on the Appropriations Committee. This would seemingly kind of allow Womack to bring home the bacon for Arkansas, as they say, but Womack seems to have a different approach to his service on appropriations, doesn't he?
Right. You know, Womack called it a 180 approach. You know, he said most people, first of all, for him to get that, he even admitted when he spoke to the spoke in Fort Smith to a Fort Smith Regional Chamber of Commerce event before the announcement, before the appointments, said it was a long shot. He knew just the chances were slim. Well, he got it, and he's just three freshmen on the Appropriations Committee, and the Appropriations Committee shrunk from 60 to 50, so that's even more of an interesting dynamic. But Womack said he wanted that role, that job, that Appropriations Committee post to help reduce the size of government, reduce the federal deficit, and you don't do that and bring home all the bacon. So, you know, the old added, you know, the old bringing it home to protect your vote, that's been turned upside down. And some analysts and political analysts I've talked to said that Womack got the position primarily because he is so strong in his district. You remember, he won with 72% of the vote. And so if the Republicans are really going to hold to that promise and cut the size of government and cut the deficit, they're going to need congressmen who are secure in their district, because there are going to be some hard and very unpopular decisions made.
And do you think that he still used that seat to bring money to Arkansas, for instance, for the I-49 highway corridor over there on the western part of the state, or for the University of Arkansas for research?
Well, that's a good question, Roby, and it's going to be an interesting thing to watch, because at least twice during that speech in Fort Smith, Congressman Womack encouraged the Fort Smith folks to be patient with I-49, that the federal government had some deep financial problems that was going to take a while to fix. It was almost as if he was hinting at saying, look, I know I-49 is important. I'm going to do what I can, but we've got a bigger problem to fix first. So that is going to be very interesting to watch, and even more, not just to watch what he's going to do, but watch to see how the people in the 3rd District in the Fort Smith area, those promoting I-49, to see how they respond.
Michael Tilley is the editor of thecitywire.com, a website devoted to the business, culture, and news of Fort Smith and Western Arkansas. He talked with Roby Brock, the publisher and editor of TalkBusiness.net. Both thecitywire.com and TalkBusiness.net are content partners of Ozarks at Large. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. Fayetteville-based Hannah's Candle Company, ranked among the top 5 candle makers in the U.S., is challenging a foreclosure complaint by Bank of America, the nation's largest bank. Ozarks' largest Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
25 years ago, Fayetteville resident Bert Hanna began mixing perfumed potpourri in the basement of his home. Today, Hannah's Candle Company, situated on a sprawling campus in Fayetteville South Industrial Park, and supplies candles to all the major retailers, including Walmart and Walgreens. Bert Hanna is president of the privately held company. His brother Thad Hanna is vice president of sales.
We have about 75 full-time employees. We have a payroll of about $3 million for the local economy. We also pay this year over $300,000 in property taxes, which most of that money goes to the Fayetteville Public School System.
The company outgrew 2 factories and now operates in the 660,000 square foot facility built a decade ago with a 10-year, $2.4 million variable rate loan from Bank of America. And that's where this story begins. In 2005, the company consolidated that debt on the factory along with several other properties with Bank of America, this time for $11.2 million. Both transactions included a derivative product called an interest rate swap. It's basically a hedge against fluctuating interest rates for the term of the note.
They gave us a 5-year term note that we were happy with. It fixed our rate at a certain percent, say 7%, and a little bit less than that, and we were happy with that. We knew that's the deal that we made. It wasn't until October of 2008, when we're reviewing our loan documents, we know that the term comes up in September of 2010, we discover that the swap that they had sold us extended for 5 years past the term of the note.
For 2 years, Thad Hanna said they tried to negotiate in good faith with Bank of America.
And the last offer they gave us was for the September 2010 maturity was that they would renew our loan for 1 year, but that we had to sign a release that would indemnify them from any liability on that swap. And we weren't going to do that because we think they either on purpose or inadvertently sold us a swap that was 5 years longer than the term of the note. And we were not in the speculation business. We're just business people trying to fix our capital costs.
Hanna's chief financial officer at the time assumed the 2005 swap matched the note's duration like the previous loan. The company refused to sign the release.
We're having our payments drafted out of our account automatically. We never had missed a payment. We never had even been late. We were reducing the principal at the rate of $62,000 per month. $720,000 a year we're reducing the principal. We'd reduced the principal from $11.2 million down to $7.4 million. Now, we were on schedule to pay this thing off in 74 months at the current rate. That was never even a question in our mind that this was going to be renewed in 2010, that we would go for another five-year term and get closer to getting this thing completely paid off. And they absolutely took the position of they did not want us as a customer anymore. They did not want to refinance our loan.
Bank of America filed suit November 10th against Bert Hanna and two of his limited liability companies to foreclose, claiming he had defaulted on $16 million in loans. The suit seeks outstanding loan amounts due plus interest and to sell off the factory assets and various properties to recoup losses to the bank. On December 7th, Bert Hanna countersued Bank of America in U.S. District Court in Fayetteville. A copy of the counterclaim document furnished by the company for this story, by the way, smells like potpourri.
I mean, there's really four things that we bring to their attention. One count is fraud. One count is breach of contract. One count is breach of fiduciary duty. And one count is deceptive trade practices.
Hanna is also seeking $4.5 million in punitive damages.
We really do believe it's a David and Goliath struggle. If we don't fight Bank of America, then you know they can just choke us. And we believe that there are other companies out there that are in the same position that we are.
Thad Hanna points out that on December 7th, it was widely reported that Bank of America agreed to pay $137 million to settle allegations it was involved in municipal bond rigging. NPR reported that Bank of America has neither admitted nor denied wrongdoing in its settlement with the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve, and attorneys general for 20 states. Hanna's countersuit claims Bank of America changed the terms of the interest rate swap without his knowledge. The question is, how can a savvy growing company allow that to happen?
The swap or hedge agreement, as it was defined in the construction note and loan agreement, stated it was for the purpose of hedging borrowers' exposure to fluctuations in interest rates. So we had a history of every loan that they had ever done with us. The swap matched up with the term of the note, every loan that we had done with them. And so you're right, we shouldn't have assumed that, but we did. We assumed that our banker would never have sold us a swap that went 5 years past the term of our loan.
Thad Hanna also blames lax oversight of the derivatives market by federal regulators. He said the case, represented by Taylor Law Firm in Fayetteville, may take over a year to resolve. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Ahead on Ozarks at Large, today's edition of the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keeler, a conversation with photographer Don House, and we'll sit down with Dr. Ralph Lorenz, a leading expert on Titan, the largest moon orbiting Saturn. He delivered the Barringer Lecture last week on the University of Arkansas campus. The KUAF and Friends holiday giveaway continues this week. The giveaway itself is Thursday. You could win prizes from Arkansas Yoga Center, Heartwood Gallery, Walton Arts Center, Penguin Ed's Barbecue, or War Eagle Mill and Restaurant, or many others. Details and registration available at KUAF.com. The drawing is this Thursday during Classical Music with P.J. Hrabowski. Congratulations are due for Taylor Surley and Beth Travis, both of Fayetteville. Taylor won the men's overall prize in yesterday's inaugural Fayetteville Half Marathon. Beth finished first among all women in the race. For the record, Taylor Surley ran the 13.1 miles in just over an hour and 18 minutes. Beth Travis crossed the finish line inside John McDonnell Outdoor Track Complex in just over an hour and 35 minutes. In all, 446 runners completed the course in unseasonably cold temperatures yesterday. The wind chill when the race started was two. At least the runners were moving. Many volunteers, including those handing water and sports drinks to the participants, had to battle the cold their own ways.
Well, we've actually got some heaters here. We've got some warm coffee. We all have some nice warm clothes, too, you know.
Across the street, in the middle of Garland Avenue, a volunteer named Andrea was trying to make sure that the water and Gatorade for the runners, in small paper cups, didn't freeze.
Well, we're thinking we did bring a heater, propane-generated heater, just to keep it. We already had one valve frozen, so we brought it by our heater, so we're just going to play it by ear and hope the sun cooperates here. And then we're going to move everything into the tent on the second round because they're going to hit from a different side. But we are kind of running into freezing issues. Cups are freezing together, everything. So we're just doing the best we can.
Runners, once you get moving, you can stay warm. For volunteers, I mean, you guys have a tough job.
Right, yeah. So we're kind of triple layered ski gloves, propane heater, tent, vehicles on. We're doing everything we can. But, you know, we're just here to support the runners and encourage them on since they're, you know, having to run in pretty tough winds and pretty cold conditions.
Andrea, one of the volunteers making sure the runners in yesterday's first ever Fayetteville Half Marathon remained hydrated. By the way, Rob Redwine of Fayetteville won Saturday's Magic Mile in downtown Fayetteville. It was part of the weekend's running festivities. Rob Redwine clocked in a 4:40 mile.
Looking strong. Good job. Where'd you get up that hill?
Photographer Don House doesn't make his subjects brave the cold. He wants to make the people sitting in front of his cameras feel as at ease as possible. And he's been regularly documenting these informal sittings over time. Ozarks at Large's Ivy Agnihotri-Madolker has this profile.
Looking at a collection that of Fayetteville faces that I took 20 years ago, it's a different set than the ones that I took 3 years ago. When you look at the people, it's almost as if the character has changed somehow.
Don House has innumerable stories to tell of people and places. There is not a face he has forgotten in 25 years. Every picture is a story that has been etched in his mind, and these are precisely the stories he hopes to tell through his photography project called, well, Stories. The project involves photographing Fayetteville faces against a fixed backdrop. Nothing changes except the faces.
You know, they started in 1986 on Springfest on Dixon Street during a festival there, and I just set up a backdrop and photographed anyone I could get to walk in off the street. And it was 10 years before those photographs were actually exhibited at the Walton Arts Center in 1996, 150 images of people from the area. And I think it was then that I saw how powerful that collection was. I didn't even realize it myself, that the negatives in the files really contained a real window on the community. It was like a part of the community that was, you were looking at a bit of history as well as a current, I guess, look at the community.
Don says just photographing these faces means a lot to a lot of people. Having seen photographs of individuals who aren't in the world anymore, relationships that don't exist anymore, people were moved by just looking at the faces. In 2006, Laura Goodwin from the Walton Arts Center commissioned Don to do a redo. The exhibition, appropriately named Second Class, also involved photographing several hundred people quickly during the course of a single day.
You know, of all the areas of photography that I dabble in, portraiture is the one area that I have very strict rules about, I guess, for myself. It's like there's a responsibility that I feel to the person that I'm photographing and also to the viewer that looks at it, that what you are seeing is actually a pretty good representation of this person's personality and character. And so I usually, when I photograph, I also like to photograph full body rather than faces, because there's so much information in clothing, shoes, whether the person brought something with them. And frequently when someone comes in to be photographed in these projects, I ask them to bring everything that they brought with them in and lay it on the canvas. You know, if they're carrying bags or they've got a baby stroller or whatever, just bring it in, include it in the photograph, because it says so much about their lives at this moment in time.
Don's studio is a simple place, really. Lined with photographs from stories and his other projects, it reflects the kind of images Don wants to shoot, minimalistic and, most importantly, real. For the purpose of this project, he shoots his photos only in black and white to minimize any distractions and maintain the focus on the face. Don feels the need to narrate some stories.
Let's do it. We have on the outside window, there's some of the portraits from the last, small portraits from the last project.
He walks towards a wall.
I'd like to tell you about this photograph because it's one of the most recent photographs that I've taken. On Highway 16, you eventually come to the town of Fallsville. There's only one building there. It's a small convenience store, gas station. This man, and I was there having coffee with him at his picnic table a few months ago. And this small fawn walked out of the woods while we were standing there and just walked over to us and looked at us and then turned and walked toward this busy highway. And this man jumped up. His name is Craig. He jumped up and grabbed the fawn, saved it from certain death. I always keep a camera handy, naturally, so I grabbed a quick shot, and then he took the fawn back out in the woods. But you see this very gentle man holding this gentle fawn who seems totally at ease in his arms, not struggling, he's just totally relaxed.
While photographing people's faces, Don says a connection takes place. They become a part of his family. Often his subjects don't remember him as well as he remembers them, which makes his effusive greetings seem suspicious. What they don't realize is that they've left a part of themselves and their history with Don. Sometimes people do remember and come back for a second take on their lives.
Recently, I re-photographed a mother and child that I had photographed 20 years ago, you know, a mother and an infant, and now a mother and college student coming back. Later to be photographed, and one of the benefits, I guess, of this way I do photography, which may just be pure laziness to never change anything, it could be that too, but is that when they come back 20 years later and we re-photograph them, they can put the next photograph on the wall next to the one 25 years ago, and it looks like they were both taken at the same time, but what's changed in there is the people.
As Don walks around his studio, a grandfather cuckoo clock that belonged to his father strikes two.
Step outside for a second and some other images out here.
Several images of the Fayetteville people he has clicked recently are taped to a glass wall in his studio at the Fayetteville Underground. People who participate in his project get a copy of their photograph a few days later.
This group of photos are ones that were taken last month during First Thursday. And when I saw the number of people that were coming to the Fayetteville Underground, and after I became part of it here and opened a studio, it just, I couldn't resist trying to incorporate those into this long-term Faces of the Area project. And this is, we photographed over 65 people, 34, 35 different groups. But I think what is displayed here is everything that we've just talked about at one point or another. You can look at these images and see a very happy relationships that people, it's very clear, of people who are in love, children embracing each other and having fun. As you know, the only instruction that I give people is that the chair has to be somewhere in the photograph. It's a chair that's been with me for many, many years, and there's something about that chair and the continuity of having it from photo to photo that adds a scale or something to it, but it's effective, and I like it in there.
Another element that is a constant part of Don's projects is the Arkansas landscape. The photographer's relationship with Arkansas is evident in his first book, The Buffalo Creek Chronicles.
Buffalo Creek Chronicles was a collaboration with both the writer Gary Lance and the ranch owner Sue Selman. And Sue wrote about her childhood of growing up in a group of cowboys on a cattle ranch. Gary wrote a naturalist history of a month-by-month document, really, of how the environment is changing, what's growing and what's changing as the seasons go by. And then I took a series of photographs of the ranch and the surrounding area.
His second book, Not a Good Sign, published in 2009, is a fun book about the unusual signs that he chances upon while driving on the back roads.
When I go into these small communities and sometimes come across signs that are placed unusually or have typos or something about them that brings up a level of humor that wasn't expected, I'll stop and photograph them. And one sign in particular that just made me realize I wanted to just put together a collection of them was a sign that I actually took in my town of Elkins that I live close to, where at the high school marquee had misspelled the word Christmas. And there was something about that I found really humorous. And when I passed by it, the first thing that crossed my mind was, this is not a good sign. And that was how the title of the book came into being.
For now, Don prepares to click some more faces and memorize some more stories.
The most rewarding part is when the person who's looking at the photograph realizes that you have definitely captured them, even though they may rather look differently, but they recognize that, yes, this is the real me. And that's a very rewarding thing when you can capture that.
For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Obama's Wars is one of the most important books of the past year.
There are always choices, particularly in war.
I'm Neil Conan. Author Bob Woodward joins us along with Ted Koppel for an update on the internal debate in the White House and U.S. policy in Afghanistan and Iraq. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 1 until 3, right after Ozarks at Large.
Said the way my blue eyes shined, put those Georgia stars to shame that night. I said that's a lie.
Singer-songwriter Taylor Swift was born on this date in 1989. Swift spent her early years on her family's Christmas tree farm. Her grandmother had been a professional opera singer, and Swift soon followed in her footsteps. By the age of 10, she was singing at a variety of local events, including fairs and contests. She sang the Star Spangled Banner at a Philadelphia 76ers game at the age of 11 and began writing her own songs and learning guitar at 12 years old. A stellar performance at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville helped Swift get a contract with Big Machine Records. She released her first single, Tim McGraw, in 2006, and the song became a top 10 hit on the country charts. It also appeared on her self-titled debut album in October of that same year, selling more than 2.5 million copies. In 2007, she won the Horizon Award from the Country Music Association and the Academy of Country Music Award for Top New Female Vocalist. In 2008, Swift was nominated for a Grammy Award in the Best New Artist category and won the Academy of Country Music's Female Vocalist of the Year Award and the American Music Award's Favorite Female Country Artist Award. In 2008, Swift released her next album, Fearless, which hit the top of both the country and pop charts and stayed there for 11 weeks. By the end of the year, the singer had become the highest-selling country artist of 2008. She released her most recent album, called Speak Now, in October of this year. Wiley Branton was born in Pine Bluff on this date in 1923. Branton was a civil rights leader in Arkansas who helped desegregate the University of Arkansas School of Law and later filed suit against the Little Rock School Board in a case that went to the Supreme Court as Cooper versus Aaron. His work to end legal segregation and inequality in Arkansas and the nation was well known in his time. On this date in 1577, Sir Francis Drake of England set out with 5 ships on a nearly 3-year journey that would take him around the world. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Monday, December 13th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Beckett-Barton, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
I have a completely non-Christmas-related suggestion for your day.
Okay.
How weird is that?
It's kind of odd this time of year.
Today, for the first time, the Historic Bank of Eureka Springs downtown opens as a museum.
Big doings.
You can see what banking was like at the turn of the 20th century. Brass teller's cages, a pot-bellied stove, candlestick telephones, the original safe, all dating back to 1912. The bank has been John Cross's baby.
For a long time.
For a long time. And there was never a man who more passionately wanted to preserve the history of Eureka Springs. You might recognize the bank's interior from Mr. Christmas,
which was a movie filmed in Eureka Springs.
About 2004, and I was there for it. And we didn't set the bank on fire trying to light a fire in the pot-bellied stove. I don't know if John knows that. Anyway, it's inside what's called the Cornerstone Bank now at 70 South Main in Eureka Springs. It's open from 8 to 5 weekdays, and it's free.
And today's the first day.
Today's the first day. There's also an opportunity for you to make some reservations for the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad's Holiday Express train. It departs from the Springdale Depot at 6 o'clock Thursday, 6 o'clock Friday, and December 23rd. The ones that aren't sold out are selling out. So if you want to do this, the kids can ride in jammies. Santa will be there. There'll be caroling. Tickets are $15 to $50, but you should call 725-4017.
Thank you, Becca.
Thanks, Kyle.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 13th. Earlier this month, Dr. Robert Lorenz was in Fayetteville to deliver a Barringer Lecture in conjunction with the Arkansas Center for Space and Planetary Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Dr. Lorenz has spent his entire professional career working with the Cassini-Huygens mission. That's the effort to learn more about Titan, the second largest moon in our solar system.
We think of Titan as a planet in its own right. I mean, it's bigger than the planet Mercury, and it has so much going on. In many ways, it's more of a planet than many planets.
And when we mention atmosphere, that is a rarity, just to set standards here, that is a rarity for moons.
Absolutely. I mean, Titan's atmosphere is substantially thicker than the one we are breathing now, and that is completely unique in our solar system. There are a couple of other moons with, you know, atmospheres, you know, 100,000 times thinner than the Earth's, or even less than that. But Titan is really quite exceptional.
The Cassini-Huygens mission has been a combined effort of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Italian Space Agency. Dr. Ralph Lorenz began his work on the mission in 1990, and he's written the book Titan Unveiled, about what's been learned about Titan through the mission.
And, you know, we're cutting metal in the mid-90s, and the spacecraft was launched in 1997. But then it took us 7 years to get out to Saturn and Titan. So it was 2004 that we arrived in the Saturnian system and began studying Titan with Cassini's instruments. Cassini's sort of the mothership that goes around in orbit around Saturn and flies past Titan. And on the third of those orbits, Cassini released the Huygens probe, a sort of smaller self-contained package that was built primarily in Europe, which parachuted down through this smog down to the surface. And that was really a very exciting moment in planetary exploration.
Of course it was. I mean, that was the first anything that had been on that surface, at least, you know, from this planet.
Well, exactly. And Titan was the last, was the biggest unknown surface in the solar system at that time. I mean, we'd seen basically the surfaces of all the major moons. But because of this atmosphere, Titan was completely unknown. And because there was the possibility of liquids on the surface, you know, that opens the possibility of you know, lakes and rivers and you know, all kinds of familiar landscape-shaping processes under very different conditions from the Earth. So it was very much a big adventure. We just did not know what we were going to see. Would it be a cratered landscape like the moon, or would it be a global ocean, or would it be a big desert, or would it have river channels everywhere? And, of course, the fun thing is it turns out to be all of the above. Titan seems to have a very, very varied landscape, a very rich balance of geological and meteorological processes, and in many ways looks a lot like the Earth, which in some respects is quite a surprise because, you know, it's a body with a surface gravity that's about the same as the Earth's moon. You know, if you were standing on Titan, you could, you know, jump 6 feet in the air and in sort of slow motion. The atmosphere is four times thicker, and the chemistry is very different. Instead of rock, you have ice. Instead of water, you have liquid methane. But despite all of these differences, many of the landscape features we see, and in fact the cloud features and other meteorological features we see, are very similar. So the physical process is the same, but the rates and scales and working materials are different. So Titan's like a big laboratory for studying a lot of terrestrial processes.
You know, a layperson hears this and begins to let the imagination run wild of what, I don't know, decades of research might be able to tell us. I mean, could this give us hints to an earlier Earth, or...
It seems that there are some quite significant similarities between Titan today and the early Earth, and probably more particularly early Titan and the early Earth. The Earth's atmosphere, for example, you know, has about 20% oxygen in it, and the rest is nitrogen. The only other significant nitrogen atmosphere in the solar system is Titan's, but Titan doesn't have any oxygen there. It's very cold, and the oxygen basically freezes out. But it does have methane, which kind of plays the role of water vapor. But this action of sunlight on methane in Titan's atmosphere turns out to be possibly relevant for the early Earth, because the early Earth likely had a bit of methane in the atmosphere too, before oxygen appeared. Oxygen only appeared about halfway through the Earth's history, about 2 billion years ago, once plants evolved. And the same sort of organic smog may have formed in the Earth's atmosphere that we see in Titan's atmosphere today, and that would have had quite profound effects on the Earth's climate, you know, how warm the Earth would have been. And so by studying Titan, we can understand some of the physics of this kind of climate effect and process, you know, better. And of course, now we have to see everything in a sort of much wider tapestry. I think the count of extrasolar planets just went past 500. And many of these extrasolar planets that we know about are giant planets like Jupiter or Saturn. And so many of those probably have moons like Titan around them. And so there are probably a lot of maybe much warmer and therefore much more Earth-like Titans in the universe that we don't really know about, but understanding how Titan works and how that fits in with the story of the early Earth, you know, begins to paint a very rich picture of what might be out there.
You start working on a project in 1990. You get to the point in 97 where you're going to send it away. How much holding of collective breath is there among the, 16 countries that participate?
It's of that order.
I
think it's been worked out. There are certainly several thousand people who are involved at one stage or another in the development of Cassini. I mean, you know, these large space projects, especially the international ones, are you know, in a way what we do instead of building pyramids. You know, it's a collective endeavor that's bigger than any of us, and it lets us do things that we couldn't do alone. Yes, there were a lot of eggs in that basket, you know, many, many person years had been invested. Which is what the dollars pay for. It's not like we put dollar bills in a rocket and send it off into space. It's investment in technology. It's professional jobs and building not only the hardware but building international relationships and a new understanding of things. All that comes together, and then there's this focal point, the launch, where it, basically it's all out of your hands. The scientists don't get anywhere near things at that point, and it's the U.S. Air Force and the company that builds the rocket that are running things. And the history of the space business is such that there's a couple of percent chance that any given rocket is going to blow up. So we were there was a lot of trepidation that night in October 97, but the launch went flawlessly, actually, and the mission has been a great success. There was, of course, another very tense moment, which was the moment that we were supposed to hear from the Huygens probe, because it had been released from the Cassini mothership at the end of 2004 and was on its own, just with three clocks running for 3 weeks. And then it was supposed to have hit Titan's atmosphere, and the clocks would have woken it up, and the parachute would have come out at, you know, 1.5 times the speed of sound. And, you know, it was very much on people's mind that the previous year, the Beagle 2 spacecraft that had been sent to Mars was never heard from again. And, you know, we were all worried that the same fate might befall Huygens, but... you know, amazingly, the radio transmission from Huygens, which was received by Cassini and then relayed ultimately to the Earth with the data, but the presence of that signal, the fact that Huygens was transmitting, was detected by the Green Bank radio telescope in West Virginia, and that immediately told us, you know, half the battle was over. You know, whatever happened, it hadn't been lost without a trace. It had entered the atmosphere, the parachute had come out, the transmitters were on. You know, the rest is going to be gravy. But it was a very tense moment.
Something like this does not happen inexpensively. That's understood. There isn't, at times, as much resolve as there are others to spend money on exploration in space. Perhaps in the United States we're at a point where there isn't as much resolve. If you could talk to someone and tell them why it is worth doing this, what would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question, and as old as the space age itself. And as I see it, there are really three reasons for exploring planets and Titan in particular. I mean, first is that we live on a planet, and we are subject to planetary processes like convective storms and greenhouse warming and geological change. And understanding how these processes work is important to us in the long run. And we don't understand it all. We can't really understand it all just by studying the Earth, because as circumstances change, you know, the atmosphere warming or whatever it is, we can't necessarily extrapolate very well. But if we build models that can replicate what we see on the Earth, and they can replicate the very different conditions we see on other planets, then we can become more confident in predicting how things will change as circumstances change. The other point is, we have deep questions about where we come from. Are we alone in the universe? What steps led up to the evolution of life, and even before that, the chemical complexity that led to life. And Titan is very interesting because it has this rich organic chemistry. We don't think there's anything alive on Titan today. We can't be sure there's not, but we don't think so. It's for a start, it's too cold. But you have this rich chemical factory that's producing the sort of building blocks of life. And we don't know how far along the chain of increasing complexity towards life that has gone. You know, are there sets of systems of chemicals in Titan's hydrocarbon lakes that line up like DNA, that encode information, or that multiply themselves? They don't have to be DNA, but they might have similar sort of functionality. So, you know, the part of understanding where we belong in the universe is really, really a big part of that. And then the third leg, if you like, is more technological. This is a worthwhile endeavor to have smart people working on, so that for one thing in particular, smart people are encouraged to come into science and engineering. And often they won't stay in the space business. They'll move off and go into biotech or computers or something. But the economy relies on this kind of activity, and space is a great focal point for that. And in fact, even more from a more utilitarian perspective, many of the instruments we use to study the Earth and understand the changing climate originate from the planetary program. The first microwave radiometers, which is an instrument used to map out snow and ice cover on the Earth, for example. That instrument was first developed to go to Venus and understand the clouds and the surface temperatures there. So you have these spin-offs technologically that are important, but probably the most important spin-off from the space program is the stimulus into science and engineering. So these are really the three big reasons for me that I think it's worth doing space.
Dr. Ralph Lorenz is the author of the book Titan Unveiled, and is a research scientist at the Applied Physics Laboratory, Johns Hopkins University. He delivered the fall 2010 Barringer Lecture this month at the University of Arkansas in conjunction with the Arkansas Center for Space and Planetary Sciences. This is Ozarks at Large.
Conductor Simon Rattle on the Nutcracker.
Some of the tunes are so famous you even forget that someone had to write them.
Well, thank goodness Tchaikovsky did write them. Simon Rattle leads the Berlin Philharmonic in Act 2 from the Nutcracker, coming up on Monday's Performance Today from American Public Media.
Fresh Air, tonight, beginning at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Fayetteville Montessori School, accepting children from 6 weeks to 11 years old in the infant-toddler community, early primary, primary, and elementary programs. Located at 57 East Township, FayettevilleMontessoriSchool.com or 443-7812 for more information. And it is getting late, but it's still time for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. Thanks to KUAF Underwriters, it's our chance to give back to you. You could win a gift from Spring Street Grill and Catering, Sports Chiropractic Acupuncture, Ozark Natural Foods, Urban Jungle, or many others. Detail and registration available on the web at KUAF.com. The drawing will be held Thursday during classical music with P.J. Hrabowski. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Bella Vista, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. You can listen to KUAF as well as our HD channels online at KUAF.com. And if you'd like to hear a portion of today's Ozarks at Large program again, you can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Also there, a listing of all the music we use inside the shows by title and artist. A few community notes before we end today's program. The Young Actors Guild will present its production of the best Christmas pageant ever Wednesday through Saturday nights at 7, with a Sunday afternoon performance at 2. Performances take place in the Darby Community Center at North 7th and C Streets in Fort Smith. For cost, tickets, or more information, YAGonline.org. And First Security Bank continues to hold a coat drive to benefit the Boys and Girls Club of Northwest Arkansas and Peace at Home Family Shelter. Area residents are encouraged to donate coats at any Northwest Arkansas First Security location now through December 31st. Sizes from newborn to 3XL in female and male coats are needed. For more information, fsbank.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. A brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon on KUAF. Have a great Monday.